Well, good morning. Thank you for coming. Oh, yes, let's get this. Okay, good morning. All right. Well, I had a very good time yesterday evening, and I hope you did too. I've been a Barca fan for some years because I have two grandsons here. That was a picture taken in 2010. And they're both Barca fans. So I followed them. That was fun. That was fun. Okay, first I'm going to summarize what happened before. And the first two slides are the ones you saw yesterday as summary, and I'm not going to go through them in detail. Just, okay, so how do you get from the termite colony to Gaudí? And adaptationism, biology is reverse engineering, cycles is do loops, and so forth. And then I introduced Godfrey Smith's Darwinian spaces, design without a designer, the strange inversions, free-floating rationales, you've certainly heard about them by now, and the Sellers manifest image with the things of different sorts in the broadest sense of things. And raise the question, how come a manifest image? Why is there a manifest image at all? So that takes us up to yesterday, and then yesterday we had Turing as an intelligent designer, birds as sorta behavioral comprehenders. Then we did the elevator, and we found the elevator's Umwelt as an engineering concept. Again, of course, adaptationism is biological engineering. Then I briefly introduced Gibson's affordances and Hume's ideas about projection. There's the third strange inversion, and which leads to the idea of the manifest image as an evolved user illusion, evolved not designed by intelligent software engineer designers, but evolved by natural selection, designed without a designer. Two more points. We looked at Oak Ridge as an interesting example of top-down design, intelligently designed, a top-down, a multi-agent system where the agents themselves are relatively clueless, like termites. But it was also very much like good old-fashioned AI in its hierarchical top-down design where, and as we're going to see today, that's not the way we want to do business when we're talking about our brains. Okay. Also talked a bit about things made of information, such as poems and recipes and genes, and I introduced the Darwinian motto, if it works, copy it. Evolution is universal plagiarism. And introduce Shannon on channel capacity only. That is, Shannon information is not the kind of information we want. We want the concept of information as valuable, information as information, that is, as design improvement. It's any design improvement is information. Learning is design improvement. And then I ended on the point that apes, maybe we're more like termite colonies than we are, that their brains might not, termite colonies are very clever, so are apes, but they're not like us. And then I ended up at the difference between the ape's brain and ours, or between the termite colony and us, is that you can't do much carpentry with your bare hands, but you can't do much thinking with a bare brain. And we don't have bare brains. We have brains well furnished with thinking tools. And that leads us then to the cultural evolution of thinking tools, and that's really the topic for today. But I want to say a little bit more about Gibson information, because that was a little brief. Going back over things, I realized I'd left out some points that might be useful. Gibson's view is that an organism takes the energetic flux, just all the impingements on it, the t- total set of stimuli, in effect. And if you plunk an agent or a perceiver in it, that agent will sift through all that information and neglect almost everything except the part that's relevant to it. And those will be its affordances, which are then digitized as affordances. They are the categories for whatever organism it is. So it's the categorization of affordances and affordance harbingers, which are also, of course, affordances. They're useful for telling you where the affordance is going to be next, for instance. Now, misinformation and disinformation are both examples of information. Let me say one thing about disinformation. That's like propaganda or lying. It wouldn't exist as disinformation if information weren't valuable. It's a parasite on valuable information. You wouldn't be taken seriously. It's only because organisms are, in general, biased in favor of taking in their particular affordances seriously that you can then have camouflage, or you can trick organisms with something which they take to be one way when in fact it's another way. I have to say a little bit more about Gibson and Gibsonians. I don't know if any of you here are really familiar with the Gibsonian canon. Well, since I'm recommending it, I have to say a little caveat as well. If you really dive deep into Gibson, you'll go crazy. And there is a coterie of crazy Gibsonians out there that you really have to look out for. I might say that to their face. they're really fanatics. You get the general drift if I give you two of the Gibsonian mottos. The main one from Gibson himself is the information is in the light. So his idea was, don't look at this, just don't think of stimuli raining in on the retina. Think of light, think of the light as a sort of 3D world of lit things, the ambient light. And the information is out there, and you move your head around in the light and you pick things up. And some of the insights that he got from thinking this way are wonderful, just wonderful. And for instance, it's from Gibson that we got the criticism. So much work on perception, particularly on vision, before Gibson became influential, was subjects seated sometimes with their head with a bite bar or a chin rest. So they weren't moving their head. They were staring straight ahead at a fixation point. And then they were supposed to draw inferences about how they perceived shapes and objects and all sorts of things, because that was controlling your subject. But Gibson pointed out that's hardly vision. That's not vision. An animal with vision makes tremendous use of the fact that you can move your head around and you can move your eyes around. And this sort of snapshot idea of vision, first of all, it gives you the image of vision as like a movie, frames, successive frames, click, 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 click. That's what vision is. Well, there are successive saccades, but if you just think of it that way, you're going to have a very impoverished view of the resources of a visual system. So the information is in the light. And you're either equipped to pick it up or not. A squirrel on the side of a tree, the same information is falling on the tree as is falling on the squirrel. It's in the light. But the tree is not equipped to take that information and do very much with it. It doesn't have eyes. Actually, it turns out the trees can take information from the light. Recently been demonstrated that at least some species of trees, especially ones that tend to grow in dense forest, are sensitive to the percentage of reflected green in the light that falls on them. And if it gets very green, they switch their resources into growing tall because they're anticipating running out of light, being crowded out. So instead of storing energy in their root system or something like that, they shift energy into growing taller so they can stay ahead of the competition. That's a very clear Gibsonian affordance. It's relevant to the tree, and the tree responds appropriately and is equipped to respond appropriately. The squirrel responds appropriately in many more ways. The other motto, which I just love, is it's not what's in your head, it's what your head is in. And this faintly comical idea perfectly captures Gibson's complete lack of interest in what goes on between the ears. He just ignores it. And he talks about, the brain picks up the information. How? No, don't even think of that. Don't ask that question. And it drove people crazy. I mean, it drove both the Gibsonians who thought he was right and the anti-Gibsonians who thought he was nuts because they didn't get it. I think we're just now beginning to realize that there was he was wise to avoid any theory of inner representations, which were all the vogue then, because the theories that were the rage then were not the right kind of theories. They were theories that we now tend to disparage. They were the sort of boxology of good old-fashioned AI and the language of thought, and those are not very perspicuous theories of how perception and action work. So Gibson, I think, looks better and better, but you have to pick and choose because Gibson was himself something of a fanatic. Okay, end of the talk about Gibson. Two more little points about information that I can't remember if I really went over. I think I did. Information is not necessarily coded. Well, I gave some examples. For instance, when you were stealing the secret, a plaster cast is not coded. It's got very good information on that widget, but it's not in any code. It's just a replica. An example of mine that I've used for years when talking about memes is a wagon with spoked wheels traveling from town to town carries not just grain or fruit, it also carries the meme of a wagon with spoked wheels, which if you're, the dog may not appreciate that, but a human being can appreciate that. The meme of that wagon, the very idea of making a spoked wheel, is spread around by exemplars. And that's not coded. Okay, now we're ready to get underway. I don't know if you recognize what this is a parody of. The famous Obama poster of 2008, Change You Can Believe In. Now, this is very gradual change you can believe in. This is in parody, not done by the same artist, I think. But I should have had that brought in. You can find it on the web in a minute, the iconic picture of Obama in those colors and that artist. Okay. Well, can Darwin's gradualism take us all the way to intelligent design, to Turing, to Gaudi, to Einstein? Well, not without some help from Turing's gradualism. So I want to say we, human beings, are the first intelligent designers in the tree of life. So contrary to the pre-Darwinian image of the whole tree of life being the product of an intelligent designer, intelligent designers, you know, they crop up, you know, right about there, last 100,000 years. They're very recent development in one tiny twig on the tree of life. Well, really, are we the only intelligent designers? What about the beavers building dams and the insects, birds building nests, spiders building webs? Well, do they understand the reasons? I've said no. But they sort of do. They sort of understand the way the CPU sort of understands add and subtract. That is to say, Turing's fundamental little mechanical moment there of reading an instruction, which isn't really an instruction, it's only sort of an instruction. Well, that sort of instruction is sort of understood. And that's all we need to get going. So it's time to start looking closely at cultural evolution. Now, I don't know if you can read this. Can you? Well, I can point out and say, I just wanted to put a few cultural items on a PGS Darwinian space, so you got the idea. So what are our dimensions here? This is culture at the top, genetic at the bottom. So this is cultural versus genetic. And what's nice to see, if you use a PGS diagram, you can allow that things can be half cultural and half genetic. You can be in between being cultural and genetic. On this, we have growth versus reproduction, which is fine because we have, you know, aspen groves versus rabbits, slime mold versus a virus. And then on this dimension, up here, we have trust, which doesn't really replicate, but it can grow and spread like an aspen grove through a society. You may want to think of it as the trust meme replicating from individual to individual, but it might be better not to think of it that way, not as replication, but as something more like just spreading or growth. And then here, internal complexity. Viruses are relatively simple. Rabbits, considerably more complex. Words, there they are. Words, those are cultural items, relatively simple. And we have, say, religions back here. And here we have Hutterites and Protestant denominations, which breed like rabbits. There's hundreds and thousands of them. Over here we have the Roman Catholic Church, which after one brief birthing period back in the days of Martin Luther is pretty well gone into menopause, I guess. not making any more offspring, just growing. This is just a sort of cartoon of the space in which we're going to try to locate cultural evolution and its products. So how did the space of culture get filled? How come? Answer, of course, is by non-genetic information transmission. That's it. Cultural transmission is founded on genetic evolution, but it is itself non-genetic. So now we want to know, how did cultural evolution arise? Well, probably the best theoreticians on this are Boyd and Richardson. Their popular book is simply called Not by Genes Alone. And then they have a more mathematical book, which has a lot of models in it. Papers, it's a collection of papers. But Not by Genes Alone is a good source for their work. And they have what's known as the dual pathway hypothesis, that there is the genetic information highway, that's the germline, the DNA, the ovum and the sperm. And then there's a second information highway, the cultural highway, which starts out as simply another way of getting information from parent to offspring. And Avital and Jablonka, a Polish and an Israeli and Polish evolutionary theorist, wrote a wonderful book called Animal Traditions, which demonstrated, I think for the first time to a lot of people, that many animal instincts that we've always thought of as instincts aren't instincts at all, because they're not genetically transmitted. They have to be learned. Food preferences, mating displays, foraging techniques, aggressive postures, various, which look like, for all the world, like they're instinctual because all the species does it. But in fact, they're transmitted not genetically, but through this second highway. The obvious case, of course, is birdsong. And it's interesting that in birdsong, you see variation. Some birds, their song is genetically transmitted through the germline. And some birds, the only thing that's transmitted through the germline is basically the habit of copying whatever you hear from mom and dad. How do you test that? Simple and elegant. You do what's called cross-fostering. You take the unhatched eggs from one nest and another nest, and you switch them. And so when the birds hatch, they're raised by foster parents of another species. Which song do they sing? Their genetic parents' song or their adoptive parents' song? And the answers vary. There's more complications, very interesting ones. The nightingale song is particularly interesting because it's very hard to learn. And it gets more and more complex and sort of recursive. And there's a pretty good argument that that's like the peacock's tail. It's costly signaling. And what makes it costly is that you have to have a whole lot of brain power to learn it. But that's for another day. If you want to read about that, there's a good account by a philosopher named Daniel Cloud, who has a new book, brand new book, called The Domestication of Language. I recommend it. I don't agree entirely with it, but I recommend it. So once you've got this highway for transmission of information from parent to offspring, you can have social learning, because that highway can be invaded by non-parental sources. Oblique transmission, not vertical transmission. And when that happens, you get what Boyd and Richardson call rogue cultural variants. They are things that get learned by offspring that they didn't learn from mom and dad. And very different conditions apply to rogue cultural variants. The image that is just irresistible in thinking about this is the internet. The second information highway is itself highly designed, as we'll see in just a minute. Highly designed. It took a lot of R&D to design it, and something had to pay for that R&D. What paid for it was transmission of valuable information from parent to offspring, including information that was, in effect, Lamarckian, since things that an organism learns in its own lifetime don't get into its germline. That's the Lamarckian heresy, to suppose that that can happen. Nevertheless, in a species that can learn, there may be things that it would be good if it only could pass them on to its children. Animal tradition, as Avital and Jablonka say. And so the second highway has evolved to make that possible, and then that highway has been optimized, it's been streamlined, it's been designed to be more and more effective. In this parallel, the internet, what paid for the design of the internet? Well, go back and look at when it started. It was the ARPANET, and then it became the DARPANET, because ARPA changed its name to DARPA. That's the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency of the Pentagon, and it was initially built at government expense to provide swift communication between computer centers around America, which had we're doing classified research and doing military research. That's how the internet got started, and then eventually it went public. As it went public, it became much more user-friendly. Obviously, you should have seen the efforts we had to go to send an email in those early days compared to how it goes now. And of course, there were no web browsers. It still worked wonderfully, but it was many years in being optimized for general use. And now, of course, I think maybe even most of the traffic on the internet is porn and spam. Not what it was designed for, but it works very well. Those are parasitic interlopers on this highway, and that's what rogue cultural variants are. They affect the porn and spam of the second information highway between animal species. So let's look briefly at the sorts of design innovations you get for social learning. It's very important to realize that the regularities that make this possible are themselves subject to natural selection. They evolved by genetic natural selection. Prolonged infancy. We are a profoundly altricial species. The two terms used are precocial and altricial. A precocial species is one when it hatches or when it comes out of the womb, it sort of hits the ground running. It's already got adult competences. It doesn't need much parental care. And of course, in many species, it doesn't need any parental care. The parent never meets its parents. Any species that requires a childhood and parental rearing is an altricial species. We are the most altricial of species. No accident. And in general, altricial species, what does that do? Prolonged infancy gives an opportunity for imprinting on parents, and of the sort that Tinbergen and Lorentz showed for, you know, a duckling, when it hatches, will follow the first large moving thing it sees. It imprints on that and just latches on, follows it around, wants to stay with it. This provides a nice tight, actually you might say a nice tight Shannon channel, an information passing channel between the parent and the offspring, because they're in each other's company so much. And the offspring has an instinct to learn, to pay attention. Now there's chimpanzee babe and mother. Now, what's the difference between these two females? What's the most striking difference? The sclera, the whites of the eyes. Chimps don't have sclera, white. Neither do orangutans. The sclera evolved to make it easier to do gaze monitoring, to see where mother or father is looking. Experiments have shown this quite clearly. Also show things like why wearing dark glasses in front of your kids, not a good idea. Gaze monitoring is an instinct. It is a talent, a disposition, a behavioral disposition. If you don't have it, you're in trouble as a baby, because you're not going to be looking in the right place at the right time. Very interestingly, the saccadic patterns, the eye motion patterns of babies are not all normal. There are babies that don't have normal saccadic patterns. They're not looking in the right place at the right time. And this is one of the best predictors of autism. They're not looking at faces when they should be looking at faces. And it may be that the reason they're not looking at faces is that human beings have an instinct to, they've got a hunger for looking at faces. It's rewarding, it's like sugar, it's like sex, yum, yum, more face. And for some autistic babies, it's overstimulation. It's like music being played much too loud. They find it aversive to look at faces, so they don't, with terrible consequences for their later social skills. Now, that story I've just said is still somewhat controversial, and I've given you a sort of cartoon version of a more complicated story, but in outline I think it's true. Gaze monitoring, in turn, the main virtue of that is it permits shared attention. And shared attention is, of course, very important for teaching. And teaching is something that we see mothers and children doing all the time in every culture, some much more than others. Not in chimpanzees. Yes, chimpanzee young will learn nutcracking, one of the few cultural traditions among a non-human species, how you pound the rock against another rock anvil with a nut in between. But never has it been observed or filmed the chimpanzee mother trying to attract the attention of the young, say, look how I do it. You know, anything like slowing down or simply monitoring the child to see if the child is watching. No, the mother just does the nutcracking, and the child watches or doesn't watch, and may pick up the scale or may not. But there's nothing that looks like teaching. Even if there's learning from parents, there's nothing that looks like teaching in chimpanzees or orangs or any other species. No, that may be a little too strong. It looks like some bird parents may, in effect, teach their children how to fly to some degree. These are variable, and it's not saying this is impossible, it's just saying these are striking empirical facts. So you have this second information highway from parents to offspring. Once it's in place, it can be invaded. What Boyd and Richardson call oblique transmission, rogue cultural variants. And rogue cultural variants are what Dawkins calls memes. Memes take advantage of the information highways built by evolution for many species, and much enhanced in Homo sapiens. Now, I've said the word, I've talked about memes, and I know that in many quarters there is a hostility to the idea of memes that is quite salient and remarkable. And very often when I start talking about memes, I get, do memes even exist? I don't know if there's memes. I really don't. Prove to me that memes exist. That's one line of challenge that I'm quite familiar with. So I'm now going to try to prove it to you, in case you have any skeptics out there. Okay, what are memes made of? Ready? I'm going to try to answer both those questions. Now, how many of you believe this sentence? Any hands? No, everybody. It's almost comically paradoxical. Although, it's worth noting that words exist in the manifest image, but they don't exist in the scientific image. If you're a hard-boiled eliminativist, you can say, no, strictly speaking, words don't exist, because they're not made of atoms, etc. Well, I'm happy to see that here people are happy to include words in their ontology. You know, in philosophy we have this lovely tradition of nominalism, which says only words exist. Interesting that there's a sterner view, which is no, not even words exist. I'm reminded of a student of mine. I can't remember her name, but I wish I could, because she put the most wonderful sentence on her exam. This was when my early teaching career, when I was teaching the pre-Socratics, even teaching ancient philosophy. And she said in her exam, "Parmenides is the one who said, 'There's just one thing, and it's not me.'" And I thought about that for a while. And I thought, darn, she's right. And then I sort of gave up teaching the pre-Socratics. Okay. A little exercise. Dogs are a kind of what? What are dogs a kind of? Mammal? Pet? You can be of more than one kind. All right, warm-up exercise. Now this, words are a kind of what? Tools? They're not really a kind of sound. They're not really a kind of sign. Symbol. What they are is a kind of meme. Now, they don't have to be a kind of anything. Maybe they could be a kind of which there is no superkind. Kind of abstraction. Maybe that would be the only thing you could say. But in fact, I'm going to say they're a kind of meme. I'm going to try to show that. So now you see, if I can demonstrate that words are a kind of meme, then you know that memes exist, because you all believe that words exist. And I'll have my existence proof. So what are memes? They're items of culture that spread by being reproduced, sometimes with changes or mutations. There's differential replication. Some go extinct. Memes evolve just like animals, plants, and viruses, by natural selection. Very important to have viruses on the list, because people often say, look, memes, whatever they are, they're not alive, so they can't evolve by natural selection. Well, you know, viruses aren't alive either, and they are paradigm cases of evolution. HIV has evolved more since it was first sequenced, about 30 years ago, 25 years ago, than Homo sapiens has evolved since we parted company from our common ancestor, the chimpanzee. So viruses are absolutely paradigmatic cases of things that evolved by natural selection, genetic natural selection. And they're not alive, they're just basically large molecules. So memes, like viruses, are not alive, but like viruses, they're subject to natural selection. I like to say viruses are nucleic acid with attitude. They're not alive, but they have a lot of competence. They're very good at getting themselves replicated. They travel light. They don't have their own reproducing machinery. What they are very good at doing is conning a living cell into reproducing them instead of reproducing its own DNA. That's how viruses reproduce. So viruses, they don't have minds, but they're demon at getting themselves reproduced by others. Memes are software, or things made of information with attitude. They're very good at getting themselves reproduced. The ones that we see have been, along with their ancestors, very good at getting themselves reproduced. They compete for transmission and also for local influence, just like viruses. Dilbert can often be found to have some wisdom. I don't know if you can read it. "Who called this meeting? We thought you did. I think we should discuss issues and assign tasks so it's not a complete waste of time. Maybe meetings have become a life form, capable of calling themselves and thus reproducing via human hosts. Wow, good issue. So there's a rediscovery of memes, the idea that meetings might be memes. Meetings aren't alive, but that doesn't mean they can't. And they wouldn't have to be a life form, unless viruses are a life form. Okay. What are memes a kind of? I say they're a kind of ways. What do you mean? Well, ways of doing, saying, thinking that are not passed on genetically. We call those instincts or adaptations. So memes are just ways of doing something. And ways, of course, are, what are ways made of? Well, ways are design features worth copying. They're information. Other theorists of culture need memes, they just don't call them memes. They call them traditions or methods, ideas, or non-genetically transmitted adaptations. Traditions and methods are good terms, but they have connotations which are a little bit strange. Mostly we don't think of individual words as traditions. We think of traditions as being somewhat larger things than individual words, or wearing your baseball hat backwards or something like that. Methods, again, a little bit too, suggests too large a way. Ideas has a familiar objection to it, and that is, sounds sort of too psychological, too mental. You have to think of these more like Platonic ideas rather than mental occurrence, because what gets passed on, what is shared among all the people, if they share one of these ideas, is not a single mental state, and it may be variously realized in their brains. It's a way of thinking or a way of doing something. And particularly bad is to think of them as non-genetically transmitted adaptations, because this flies in the face of the single most important virtue of thinking from the mimetic point of view. So the chief virtues of mimetics are the following. First, that memes can be designed by evolution, by a competent but not comprehending designer. How often do culture theorists, recognizing the brilliant design of some cultural entity, a practice, a song, a tradition, a method, think that they have to postulate an author, an inventor, a designer of that design? No. The design can get itself replicated by differential replication and improved by differential replication without ever anybody consciously designing it or deliberately designing it. This is really the most important thing about memes, is that they are designed by a process that is competent without comprehension. People in the humanities routinely over-endow agents, human beings, with comprehension of the benefits that they enjoy. And just as the little cuckoo doesn't have to understand the free-floating rationale of pushing the eggs out, that's an instinct, so people don't have to recognize the free-floating rationales of a lot of the behaviors that they engage in. Even when theorists, sociologists, psychologists, political theorists, and so forth, have figured out what the rationale is, that can be the first time that's been figured out. The spread and fixation of a pattern of behavior does not require comprehension. If it's a good enough behavior, it will spread to fixation simply by differential replication. I have some examples of that a little later on. And that the other main feature is that memes have their own fitness, and that's what's wrong with the non-genetically transmitted adaptations vision, because it always ties fitness and evolution to the fitness of the host. Indeed, many culturally transmitted innovations do seem to be obviously fitness enhancers for the host. Thus, let's take a trivially obvious example. Doing exercises to build up your flexibility and strength, passed socially, proving the fitness in several senses of the hosts. That looks like an adaptation for sure, not genetically transmitted. Let's suppose it's not an instinct to exercise, but a cultural tradition. So that looks fine. It looks just like any other genetically transmitted adaptation. But a lot of memes have their own fitness, which is simply independent of the fitness of the hosts. When I was writing my book on religion, Breaking the Spell, Religion as a Natural Phenomenon, and people learned this is going to be an evolutionary, naturalistic theory of religions, I routinely encountered the remark, oh, so you're doing an evolutionary account of religion. Every religion, every society that's ever been looked at has some kind of religion, right? I said, yeah, pretty much. I don't know any exceptions. So what do you think religion is good for? As if it was obvious that if it was ubiquitous, it had to be for something that benefited human beings. And my reply was, every human group ever looked at has the common cold, too. What's it good for? It's good for itself. It's good for replicating. It's a parasite. You can have parasitical memes. They have their own fitness. They don't have to benefit us. Now, there wouldn't be memes unless the information highway that does benefit us had been designed and built and maintained by genetic evolution. But once it's there, it is susceptible to be invaded by parasites. And they have their own fitness, which is independent of us. Also, of course, memes are things made of information, just like genes. So, these are the chief theoretical virtues of thinking of memes. So now, words are memes that can be pronounced. That's my definition. This is like Homo sapiens. This is genus and species. Genus, meme, species can be pronounced. There's lots of memes that can't be pronounced. But we're going to look at the memes that can be pronounced because they're so familiar and they're so easy to talk about. And they are the best examples. Words themselves are the best examples of memes. Now, this raises an interesting question. Why didn't Dawkins make this point when he introduced memes? And I plan to have a long discussion with Richard about this. We've begun it, but not gotten very far. Too many other things to talk about. But I think I know one of the reasons is that he didn't want to seem to be reinventing the wheel invented already by his hero, Darwin. Here's what Darwin said way back in 1871, more than 100 years before Dawkins wrote The Selfish Gene. The survival or preservation of certain favored words in the struggle for existence is natural selection. Yeah, and Darwin himself has a theory of sorts, or not a theory, but just observations which amount to a preview of meme theory with words as the main candidates. He had noticed that many of the features he had characterized for organic natural selection were also to be found in the lineages of words. And in fact, they have clear genealogies. Words have clear genealogies. They have trees, family trees. They have clear histories of adoption. At least now they do, because now they have these nice fossil traces called printed words, which are, of course, themselves tokens of memes, and that that can survive sort of as fossils long after. Spoken words have very short lives. And so spoken words, in order to reproduce, have to be memorable and important and attention-holding. And often, in order to preserve words, well, I'll put it, Dawkins talks about the selfish gene, and a lot of people get nervous about that selfishness talk. I'm going to talk about selfish memes. Selfish memes, like viruses, provoke their own replication. Words want to get said. Why? So they don't go extinct. A word that's never said goes extinct. If you want a sketch of a theory of speaking in Consciousness Explained, I have a theory. The chapter on speaking is how words do things with us. And the point of it is to give a model of competitive words as competing to get themselves into utterances. And to this day, I think it's the best sketch of a theory of speaking that there is. In fact, I think it's almost obligatory, because you can't have a theory of speaking which has a Cartesian race cogitans at the center that's thinking thoughts and then choosing the words very carefully to put in place. That's too much intelligence in the head homunculus. You don't want that. You want to have words. You want to have a process of sentence creation which is competitive, and where there isn't a boss. And the way you do that is by having competition between words. That's a little bit too simple, but the basic idea is, I think, right. So words have clear genealogies, clear histories of adoption and transmission. And they have relatively clear identity conditions. Linguists make lots of fine distinctions. My wonderful colleague Ray Jackendoff talks about lexical items, which include words, which can be pronounced, but he breaks words down into parts so that the irregular plural of child, children, that the ren suffix, with the change in the pronunciation of the initial vowel, is a lexical item. And it's a meme. You have to learn it. It's not really pronounceable. It's a rule for how the plural works, for the irregular plural works for the noun child. There's lots of diversity among words. Where do they all come from? They come from thousands of languages. The number, of course, is diminishing. Languages are going extinct at a great rate. If you want to do something really valuable, you could become a field linguist and preserve a language that's on the edge of extinction. There are quite a few linguists out there doing it, but not enough. If I were young, I think I would try to take some years off and do that just for the thrill of learning a language before it went extinct. Because once it's gone, it's gone. Deader than a dodo. And languages are so different that they're cultural treasures. They're very much worth preserving. And one of the effects of contemporary culture is that we're heading towards a sort of monoglot world. We're going to have a great diminution in the number of languages that are still not extinct. Of course, they can be preserved the way ancient Greek or Hellenic Greek or Roman Latin, and that's what we'll have to do. We'll have to artificially preserve languages, not by preserving populations of native speakers. That's not going to work. Could all these thousands of languages have a common ancestor? They could. People argue about this. You can trace back the trees somewhat. So we've seen phylogenetic trees, like the tree of life diagram that I've showed several times. Well, actually, before there were phylogenetic trees, which was an innovation of Darwin's, although there's some earlier examples that can be arguably called early examples. But there's that famous tree sketch in his notebooks of how species might evolve, might have their origins. But before there were phylogenetic trees, there were glossogenetic trees. I don't have any ancient ones here, but these are some modern ones. This is the Proto-Indo-European languages. Too tiny here to read, but that's a diagram of the, and you can see it's a tree of life with branchings. Here's the Finno-Ugric languages. Here are the languages of China. Here are the Proto-Mayan languages. And I just pulled these off the web. There's lots of different glossogenetic trees that have been worked out by linguists. And you can trace them back. And one of the most interesting areas of evolutionary research going on right now is being done on the languages of the Pacific Islands, because you can study genetically and linguistically how these languages spread from island to island. And there's some very interesting discoveries that are being made about this. And you can also get evidence about tempo of change and mutation. The trouble with doing language lineages is that horizontal word transfer is a very widespread phenomenon, as we know. There are many Spanish words in English, and now many English words in Spanish, right? What are some Spanish words today that clearly came from English? Mouse? Yeah. Software? Yeah. You know, the French didn't want to talk about computers, ordinateur. Yeah, I don't think anybody uses that word anymore. Maybe. So I call this horizontal word transfer because its parallel is horizontal gene transfer, which was long viewed as not happening. Horizontal gene transfer is when genes from separated species merge together in a single species. It's now known that it does happen, rarely in large multicellular organisms like us. But in the early days of evolution, it was very common. In fact, it played a big role in the earliest days of evolution on the planet, back in the days of unicellular organisms only. And so what happens is that at a certain point, as you are researching back and trying to figure out the origin of life and what the earliest organisms were, it turns out that the genes are much easier to trace than the organisms that they were the genes of. And the trees diverge. There's a beautiful account of that in Dawkins' book, The Ancestor's Tale, if you want to read about that. It's, as usual, crystal clear and vivid. So Horizontal word transfer is a fact of life, and anastomosis is what branch joining horizontal transmission is called, and it's rife in languages, so words are more trackable than whole languages. Now, in general, memes are hard to track because of convergent evolution. And you don't know whether something has been invented separately three different times or whether it's by transmission. So let me make it obvious, give you an obvious example. We find that the canoes made in the Japanese islands bear a striking resemblance to the canoes made on the South American coast. They're pointed at the front end. That must mean that there's a transmission of pointed front end that runs from one to the other. No, no reason to suppose that at all, because putting a point on the bow end of a boat is sort of a no-brainer, and it will be invented again and again. So there's no evidence that there's a common ancestor. A more far-fetched example, but it'll bring out the point. Suppose that SETI works, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, and we start communicating with a distant galaxy or a nearby planet. And strangely enough, they have arithmetic. Shouldn't be surprised. Strangely enough, they have decimal arithmetic. That's more interesting because they could have had octal or binary only, or what was it, base hexadecimal? Wasn't that what the Aztecs had? Or they had base 36, I think, for a while. But still, the conclusion I would draw if it turned out that another culture had decimal arithmetic on another planet is, well, I don't know what they look like yet, but I bet they got two of these with five of these. Because if they had two with four, they would probably have octal arithmetic. So I would be inclined to draw the tentative conclusion, if they've got decimal arithmetic, the fact that we have five instead of four or three, like, you know, Mickey Mouse, there's probably a rather deep engineering reason for it. It's probably a good trick in a way that we don't understand yet, because it's been reinvented on another planet. But now suppose that these extraterrestrial intelligences, when we look at their numbers, we finally get some pictures from them. We find that they're using 1, 2, 3, 4. They're using the very same symbols that we use. At this point, I would be unhesitatingly sure that there was a common ancestor, that there had been prior transmission, because there is simply no reason why those symbols should be the right ones for the first 10 digits. You could have used any other shapes at all, and the fact that they had hit upon the same shapes would be a clear sign of information transmission, high fidelity information transmission between their culture and ours. That's what you need, that kind of idiosyncrasy to clearly establish lineages of memes. And very often it's just not available. You can't tell reinvention from cultural transmission, because people are clever and they're going to invent a lot of the same ideas without any help from models that they get from elsewhere. That's one of the big differences between cultural evolution and evolution by natural selection, is that we got clever vectors, clever hosts, clever environments for memes that we don't have for genes. More about that. I put down inventing the wheel, because we talk about reinventing the wheel. It's even a meme, reinventing the wheel. We've all heard it. It's got a pretty robust life in the memosphere. And for good reason. The concept that it refers to is itself a ubiquitous concept. It's a feature of cultural evolution, which has no direct parallel in genetic evolution. Close. For instance, eyes have evolved, I forget how many times they now think, but at least, let's see, in invertebrates, in mollusks, in insects, those are three different evolutions of eyesight. And in a way, they all reinvent the same wheel. They all use the protein rhodopsin because it's such a good transducer of light, which itself is a evolved product of bacteria rhodopsin in bacteria, which wasn't used for vision or light sensitivity at all. It had another use entirely. But three times, lineages reinvented the wheel as we saw. Ooh, I can put this rhodopsin protein to interesting use. I'm going to make an eye. So eyes have been reinvented several times. So now we have to look at whether mimetic evolution is really Darwinian. And thanks to Peter Godfrey Smith, we're ready for the answer that it's only sort of Darwinian. And I'll just do these a few slides on this, and then we'll break. Maybe it's only quasi-Darwinian. First of all, one of the major features of most natural selection, not all, is competition at loci for alleles. You have a locus in the genome where there's several alternates, and they're in competition for that slot. And that's maybe the driving process of evolution right there. And a lot of people say, no, but we don't have that in memes. Yes, we do. I'll show you. They are sort of not very interesting, but there they are. Different pronunciations. You're going to pronounce it controversy or controversy. Depends where you are. Data or data. Now, one of these is probably going to go to fixation. Neither one's gone to fixation yet. They're in competition for a locus in the culture. We also have competition for meanings. If somebody comes up to me and says, "Dan, that was a terrific lecture, just incredible," I don't say, "You mean you were terrified? And you didn't believe it?" Those words have changed their meaning. Completely changed their meaning, and that's been a mimetic evolution over time. Go back far enough, and that would have meant something different. Synonyms. Which synonym are you going to use on this occasion? And you realize that sometimes you very consciously decide to use a synonym or a euphemism when you could use another word which means pretty much the same thing. Or depending on which crowd you're with, you use the fancy term or the slang term or the obscene term or whatever. These choices are instances not of regular artificial intelligence, regular evolution, but of artificial evolution, or what Darwin calls methodical selection. If you haven't read The Origin of Species, you've got a treat in store for you. It's really great reading, beautifully written. It's a literary masterpiece, among other things. And the book is very cleverly designed. He begins with domestication, and he begins with animal breeding, pigeon fanciers and horse race breeders of racehorses and cattle and dogs. And he points out that methodical selection manifestly works wonders very fast. And he's got all these examples of all the different kinds of pigeons and all the different kinds of dogs and horses and cows. And then he brilliantly points out that before there was methodical, deliberate, intended selection, there was what he called, bless him, unconscious selection. Unconscious selection. This was the gradual move into domestication, where the owners of the dogs were not trying to breed a particular dog. They were simply, without even thinking about it, neglecting or favoring some of the litter and neglecting the rest. And over time, this would accumulate changes. And unconscious selection is a big phenomenon, even today. I'll give you one example. We'll quit right there. Laboratory mice have been deliberately bred for hardiness. They're being relatively happy to live in cages with sawdust on the floor. They digest the standard lab diet well, and they tend not to try to bite people that want to do experiments with them. That's what they've been methodically bred for. Willy-nilly, they've been unconsciously selected for having relatively short lifespans and having a whole lot of other features which they do not share with their wild-type relatives, their undomesticated closest relatives. So recently, for instance, there was a flurry of excitement when somebody thought they'd found a gene for longevity, the fountain of youth gene, in laboratory mice. Turned out all they'd found was a genetic change which they'd unconsciously bred out of the mice by unconscious selection, and they were simply returning the mouse to its lifespan it has in the wild when it's not killed. So they weren't discovering something that could make any mouse older. They were simply undoing the unconscious selection of their breeding program in the lab. On that note, let's stop and have a coffee break. Let's stop and have some questions. I keep forgetting that.
For me, this is like a trip down memory lane, because I remember sitting in the class with you when you were introducing memes in developing Darwin's dangerous idea, and I got captivated by the idea of a meme and spent the next few years obsessing about them.
And do you realize how long ago that was?
That is now half of my lifetime, let's put it like
20
that.
20 years ago.
Yes. And I was trying to think of the fact why this move wasn't seen by such great minds like you and Dawkins and some of your students in that class. And it occurred to me that one fact about memes that was emphasized then that you don't emphasize now has dropped out. And I'd like to hear more about your reasons for that. So at the time when we were thinking about memes, you were thinking in terms of the smallest cultural unit, because that's the way in which Dawkins was kind of presented a cultural unit that can be transmitted with reliability, fecundity, etc. And it was obvious to us, I think, that words were on the whole not in all circumstances, the smallest cultural unit. Earlier in the week, you mentioned phenomes and, you know,
phonemes.
Phonemes. Yeah, I keep getting that word wrong. I think it's a Freudian resistance. Earlier in the week, you mentioned phonemes. At the time, you were, I think, obsessing about tunes of various sorts that would stick in your head. But that all were kind of sub-worldly, sub-propositional in various ways. And so that clearly was a bad idea, focusing on smallest cultural unit. But it is a question why we can really give up on smallest unit talk, because that's, after all, what allows us to apply the genetic metaphor really so well. So I don't think of this as an objection, but I want to hear more about what's happened with that idea.
Well, as you know from the piece I showed you a few days ago by my student, the one that's now up on Edge, edge.org, we've just put a piece that he and I and another professor at Tufts have written, a commentary on Dawkins. My student has figured out that a better example of replicators in the genetics world is not the genes as they're normally considered, but they're gene fragments, smaller parts of the gene, because they replicate, they meet Dawkins' definition of a replicator, and it turns out that protein domains make better interactors than Dawkins' vehicles do. So I think we have to say that Richard had some brilliant ideas back there in 76, and he made a presciently loose definition of what a gene was and what an interactor was. And in the intervening years, that definition has, people have had to use that looseness to move the Dawkinsian categories around, and this is still going on. We haven't heard back from Richard yet what he thinks of that paper. I'm hoping to get a reply soon. If it comes by tomorrow, you'll hear about it. George Williams gives the definition of a gene as the shortest, but he calls it information, so not the shortest sequence of codons, maybe the shortest sequence of information that robustly resist dissolution over generations. It's a sort of circular definition, but it's right. It captures the main point. Dawkins himself argues that you could think of each codon, each A, C, G, or T, as a replicator at the loss of all explanatory power. That's why you don't really want to think of a phoneme as a replicator. Well, it is a replicator, and it can move from language to language, but for most purposes, it's not very interesting because it doesn't have enough interaction effects. As I say that, I realize I think that it's not as true for phonemes. I think phonemes are better memes than codons or genes. Phonemes really are quite wonderful as memes, because they do replicate, they do get copied, and they do interact. And they owe their replication. What enhances their replication is their success at interacting. So I do think that it's amazing that we didn't. I went back and read Dawkins to see, and in his initial list of memes, his initial list of examples, he has catchphrases. That's the only word-like thing that he calls a meme. And I have a feeling that one of the reasons he did it is that he wants to say, for instance, fashions are memes. And it's not just fashions with names like miniskirt or Hume hat. It's wordless, unnamed ways of doing things which can spread. And so it was very important to him to divorce memes from words and not have you insist on the fact that these were just ideas and words were their clothing. And so he underestimated the power of words as an example of a meme. But I'm not, that's a good question, worth further discussion.
I would like to go back to what you said about religion being a sort of parasite. And I would like to hear a little bit more about how is it that there are all these memes that seem to have, their only function seems to be just to stay there. I mean, how is it that we let them? After all, memes are cultural genes and culture depends on us, so how is it that they manage to reproduce and replicate in a way that has no use whatsoever for us? When you think in terms of general evolutionary terms.
Because they have blindly discovered a niche, a crack in our armor, a foible, a weakness in our psychology, in our brains, that they can spread through. I mean, if you think about simpler things, then religions are great big, complicated things. And they're composed of memes. But you really want to break it down and see. For instance, you have think about memes for. Stirring rituals. Mm-hmm. Religions almost always have stirring rituals.
Sure.
So do fanatical groups of that aren't religious at all. So do Nazis, So do criminal gangs. Rituals are very clever. They don't have to be invented by clever priests or clever gang leaders. They just have to be adopted. And differential adoption. The gangs that don't adopt them won't be gangs for long.
Then you would say, well, that's their function, like the rituals have a function, and then the function of religion is to break or reach down certain psychological factors things like that.
But you see, that's whether it's good for people or not. The function is, you measure it, it has the function of being attractive to people. They copy it. They may think it's good.
That I understand, yeah. Sure.
They may think it's bad, but they copy it. Let me give you an example, which I know you will understand. Probably you all will because you've heard enough American. A few years ago in my class where I was right about at this point in my discussion of memes, a student said, I'd really like an example of a parasitical meme. And I said, well, like maybe a like term that like you sort of like inserted all over the place in like almost every sentence you like said. And he says, I get the point, I want an example. Now, he didn't even hear that I was parodying his own linguistic habit. I do not think that's a good habit. I don't think it's fitness enhancing. I think it spreads. At a religion, evolution of religion conference, I was particularly amused and in the end depressed by how many of the people there thought there just had to be, there couldn't be memes that were parasitic, that somehow spread thanks to a weakness in the human constitution. And I said, oh, I know an example. How about masturbation? And to my horror and dismay and delight in the end, they began busily trying to think about why masturbation was an adaptation. It's practice. It's getting you ready for mating. It's making you a more able procreator. Give me a break. But you see, they thought if they couldn't come up with something like that, they couldn't be Darwinian. And the point is, no. Darwinism has more tricks up its sleeve than just finding adaptations that enhance a host. In fact, my other favorite example of this is, particularly for a crowd like this, getting a college education, if eating broccoli had as potent a depressing effect on your genetic fitness as getting a college education, it would have to have a warning label. Caution, eating broccoli may reduce your genetic fitness. Why? Because getting a college education, all the statistics show, you're much less likely to have a lot of kids and grandkids than people that don't. That's fitness. The fact is, we don't care about our genetic fitness. And most, when you look at that perspective, many of our cultural practices are not fitness enhancing. They're fitness reducing. We don't care. Because having more grandchildren than everybody else is just not what we think life's all about. So we need another set of norms for the fitness of memes. But for the memes themselves, it's same as with Darwin. Replication. Just the way Monod says, the dream of every cell is to become two cells. The dream of every meme is to become two memes. And then four, and so forth.
I'm curious about the difference between your approach to cultural evolution and Dan Sperber's look on cultural evolution. Because at some point when I look at it, it strikes me as a terminological difference. At other times, it's more a question of emphasis. Back in the day, it struck me as a difference in substance. And right now, I just wanted to know what your views are.
Your perceptions are, in each case, accurate. I'd wondered the same thing. And there was a Sperber Festschrift conference in Paris a year and a half ago in December. And I went and gave a talk on just this. And Dan leapt into the fray to say what he thought the differences were. And it was very instructive. We went off and had lunch together. And sketched out on the placemat his view and my view. And then began to see how we could put them together. And we actually thought of writing a paper together. there are some differences. And then I didn't stop there. I said, let's have a workshop on this. I'm on the external faculty at the Santa Fe Institute. One of the things you get to do is organize workshops. So I organized a workshop and invited the Paris gang, Sperber, Clédier, Mercier, but Mercier couldn't come, and Olivier Morin, and then Boyd, Richardson, Henrik, Sterelny, Peter Godfrey Smith, Sue Blackmore, and me. That was the gang. And we had an amazing week of sorting out our differences. And that website that Sperber runs has the summary. We didn't do any volume. We're not going to do a volume. But the general conclusion of the week was that most of our differences are because we're looking at different parts of the phenomena. I'm sure that at a different grain level. And if you just bear that in mind, you can fit the pieces together pretty well. Dan, for instance, Dan Sperber, acknowledges now that the one thing his approach can't explain is the good designedness of cultural items. It can't explain adaptation of memes. It's good at differential spread, but there's the whole engineering adaptationist reverse engineering aspect of it gets lost because it's cultural attractors. It's just like physics, and it's not that these are things are good for anything. That's part of it. You can consult Sperber's website for that.
Okay, let's stop.
Oh my goodness.